Greetings, Race community. Brent coming in live with today's guest, Ashley Budd, who is a senior advancement marketing director at Cornell University, also a nonprofit consultant, a keynote speaker, and most recently, author of Mailed It. Welcome, Ashley.
Hello, Brent. Hello.
It's so nice to see you.
You too.
Not quite as nice as the last time I saw you, Ashley and her family. Hope you don't mind me sharing.
No.
Came on a vacation to Puerto Rico, happened to be in my town, and we were able to meet up and have a lovely spring break hello. So not quite the same vibe.
So much fun.
Yeah.
We were ready to move. We were ready to enroll, Cora.
Welcome back anytime. But today we are going to talk a little bit about your career journey, make sure that we dive into your work with Mailed It, and hopefully provide some lessons to our audience while ensuring we don't provide too much so that they go out and buy a whole bunch of copies for themselves, their team, holiday season upcoming here. So Ashley, before we get into some of your more recent work, let's learn a little bit about who you are. I've been fortunate to know you for a good decade or so on my entrepreneurial journey, but let's go back even further. Who was the Ashley of high school? Where were you? What was she into? What led you to RIT?
All right. I am back where it all started. I live in Saratoga Springs, where I did all the things in high school, I think. Ended up at RIT because I wanted to go to art school, but I also took AP Physics and other stuff like that. And my drawing teacher said, Ashley, if you want to go to art school and get a job, you go to RIT. And so, very smart man, Mr. Fantasi, he was right. Went to RIT, graduated with some private school debt and a BFA in Fine Arts Studio, and decided, yeah, maybe I'll stay and get a, you know, a business degree, and be able to, you know, understand my own way in the business world. So I was a student ambassador. The classic entry, you know, point into a higher ed career is you're a tour guide on your own campus. And I asked the admissions director for a job and spent 6 years in enrollment at RIT at the time when social media became a thing. So I launched the social media platforms out of that enrollment office.
The even more common way on this podcast, the on-ramp, mm-hmm. was the call center, right? For many advancements.
The call center. So, yes. No, my roommate did the call center.
I was the tour guide. Mm-hmm. You did the tour guide. The tour guide has to be the on-ramp into enrollment. That's got to be.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
So
yes.
Tell me about the world of enrollment management at that time. What were you actually as an entry-level professional in that part of the world?
Yeah. So I brought my millennial self and my love of MTV Real World and wanted to put five of our student tour guides on YouTube and show, you know, five students picked and, you know, what's their real life going to be? and so I got, you know, I was watching a lot of what MIT was doing at the time with their blogging program with students, which is still an incredible program. I just read a recent blog over there that blew me away. But anyway, there's always been this kind of digital through line, leveraging new platforms. I helped redesign the admissions website during that time. I taught myself HTML and was, you know, doing the e-newsletters. And because I had a design background, was taking all their print material, you know, at the front desk and redesigning it, and had my hands in a lot of things. And when Facebook became open to the public, and we started asking, would it be creepy for us to have a Facebook page? And yes, let's do that. And so, yeah, social was my, the way that I made the move over to the advancement world.
And so in the admissions work that you were doing, though, or enrollment mm-hmm. work, maybe is a better way to say it,
mm-hmm.
that is a business that is also a real mix of marketing and sales.
Major.
Right, building the list and creating the audience. But then ultimately, you know, as you move sort of down the funnel, admissions officers or enrollment officers might be out at college fairs, sort of literally doing
Yeah.
the
Oh, yeah. I was boots on the ground. My territory was all five boroughs of New York City and Long Island. Just a
And so when you say
small
your
area.
territory, like what does that mean?
What was that? Say that again.
When you say your territory, for
Oh,
those
my
that don't
territory.
have experience in the enrollment world, what is it
Yeah.
territory? What are you actually trying to
Yeah.
achieve?
So I was 6 months out of the year I was in New York, and on Long Island in schools, interviewing students, doing, just drop-ins to guidance counselors and college fairs and all of these things. And I really relied on the student ambassadors that I had to run all of the other, all that other stuff that I was mentioning. I gave them the keys and they supported a lot of the marketing. But it was a very romantic job, meeting with students in these incredible high schools, lots of first generation students, and so passionate about education and being able to like be that doorway into the next phase of life. And so I really felt like I was going to the dark side when I took the advancement job.
When you think back at that time, are there any specific students, specific conversations, specific
Yes.
school visits that stand out?
Oh man, yes. I remember a specific interview at Bronx Science High School, and was speaking with this student who was so stressed out because she did not have a leadership position in any of the organizations at her school. And she felt like this was, there's no way she's going to college because, I didn't get a leadership position. And she said, I tried. I just need you to know that I tried really hard to get one. And when I walk around school, I can see people with their leadership positions like hanging over their head. This was a big thing for her. And then when I asked her what else she was doing, she, told me the story about how she's involved in music and the orchestra and how she had just gotten back from playing for the Pope. And the student just had this, this like checklist that she was told about what it meant to be to prepare herself for college, and she was so incredible. And so being able to meet those students who had such a passion for what they were doing and kind of easing their anxieties on going to the next step, that was a really special interview. I'll always
Great
remember that one.
memory. Thank you for sharing.
Yeah.
And as you made the shift to advancement, that also was a shift in institution, right? I mean, that's when
Yeah.
you.
Yes. There was a position posted at Cornell for a social media strategist in advancement. And I've come to learn that I'm a pretty calculated person. So I was thinking at this time that I was going to go and take this position in advancement, learn that side of the higher ed business because I didn't know anything about it. And then I would move myself back to Saratoga, and land somewhere in kind of a central communications role. But if I could, put Cornell on my resume and learn a little bit about advancement, that I would be setting myself up for this next move. And I got great advice from Michael Stoner, who said, if you want to go learn digital and advancement, you go and you learn from Andrew Gosen. And that was great advice. And when the time came to move, I got to take Cornell with me. So I've been working from Saratoga remotely since 2014.
Yeah, so you got that advice from Michael Stoner 12 years ago, and still with Cornell, and your scope and your work has evolved a lot since then.
Yeah.
But tell me what it was like to leave your alma mater, where you must have known everything and everyone by the time you left, to sort of, I don't know, I guess maybe being a little more anonymous, at least in your initial
Oh, yeah.
to a larger team at a place you didn't know. Like, how was
Yeah.
that?
Yeah. Well, I was very curious, and that's why I needed the advice from Michael, because this role that I was walking into was full-time employee number three as a social media strategist with an advancement. in 2013, where there was, you know, there weren't full-time roles at university for social media people hardly anywhere. And here's Cornell with three FTEs. and so something was up there. And I had also just stood up, you know, the social media presence for all of our IT. So I, you know, I'm second guessing myself, why am I going to go sit third string on this advancement team? And then I also, you know, thought, okay, RIT and Cornell, that's going to be a lot of engineers. It's, you know, same size university, about enrollment wise, it's Western New York. I get this place already, but it was like going from a mom and pop shop to working for Coca-Cola. Like, it was incredible scale. There were, I think at the time, 400 people in the advancement division. And that's why there were three people working on social media. And it was because they really saw the internet as a new region and they wanted to staff it like they had staffed their regional programs. And how many people did we have dedicated to engaging people in New York City or in the Bay Area? Well, we certainly are going to need to staff people who are, just exist online for us. So it was very smart. And it's been, you know, it's been incredible, the stuff that we've been able to do there.
So what did you walk into? Sort of what was the what was the actual level of let's call it engagement with these platforms, and where, you know,
let's take ourselves back to 2013. We were pretty engaged in Facebook and Twitter. Instagram was very, very new at the time. And we were, you know, charting out things in spreadsheets. Who was liking our posts? Who was, you know, who's engaging on this stuff? Because we knew it wasn't just about volume. It was about who exactly we were reaching. And so it was a labor of love to try to understand that. Yeah, we were spending a lot of time doing kind of our own data mining and LinkedIn too. That was before LinkedIn kind of had a social side to it. But we knew there was better information there than what we had. So yeah, that was and a lot of, you know, I think one of the most exciting things about being on that team was the ability for our brand to just be, you know, the alumni communications to just be separate from Cornell proper brand. And so the outward message to students and families can take a different tone than the more cheeky, fun what we were doing on social for alumni. And to be able to do that at Ivy felt like we were also, you know, showing the industry, like, you have permission to have some fun on these platforms here.
I mean, that's what I reflect on, you know, having gotten to know you and your team during that journey, is that, you know, if you think about just the context for web communications, the external brand, it was sort of across the board, pretty buttoned up, very little authenticity, or I shouldn't say authenticity. Not as much authenticity as sort of what you would experience if you were walking around on a campus tour, for example. It was much more, I don't know, by the book, structured, little risk, safe. And I think that's where, you know, you all and others started demonstrating, like, look, and I think that's one of the great things about social, and we'll talk about it in the context of email as well, is there is a scoreboard. Like, you quickly learn what works, what resonates. You know, by way of likes or comments or reactions, there's a real-time feedback loop that, compared to traditional communications, the beautiful, you know, print piece that went out, or the beautiful campaign materials, or the beautiful redesigned website, there's very little real-time feedback around how did this make someone feel today? And I feel like once you started, you know, like, even to this day, it's my, I was reviewing a social platform for a customer 2 weeks ago. And it was like, all you're doing is asking for money. Please give link, please give link. It's mind boggling to me that that is still happening.
Oh, in
2024. But it's like you could just see no one's responding. You have no audience because it's not interesting. It's not fun. It's not engaging. And I think that's where you all were able to both build a real audience by doing like genuinely creative, authentic things, which then gave you the permission to also activate those channels in a strategic way for direct solicitations without that just being the thing.
That, I mean, that honesty, what's really happening right now kind of messaging. I do think we figured that out early. I think we also had a great web team. Like, we had a lot of really digitally minded people, so we were learning, all the UX practices of what was going into web at the time, and that was really applicable to social, because if what you were asking people to do was not easy to follow, they couldn't take those steps, those next steps. So I think we saw results quicker because we were able to move on some of that part of the experience. I think what we found out later in the pandemic, and as my portfolio grew beyond social to include email and direct mail and all of the channels, was the we needed the authenticity, sure, but we also needed this extra layer of empathy for the audience, and a real focus on what value are we providing. What is that ex what's that balance between how much we're cultivating this relationship versus how much we're asking? And once we really intentionally level set that, and that's hard to do in an organization, to tell people we're going to spend less time focused on these conversions and we're going to spend more time doing this stuff that feels like totally new programming. But that's where we were able to really buck a lot of the industry trends for years with donor decline, because we had built this really the different kind of trusting relationship, and a lot of it was done just through digital.
Well, we have accidentally but authentically stumbled into the content of your book now, and now you're making a triangle. So why don't we just go there? But first, given everything you just described, if I had received a note from you saying that you were going to be writing a book and the book was called Posted It, for example, that wouldn't have shocked me, right? Like a how-to guide on social media strategy. A lot of the content maybe would be the same because it's sort of the same principles of just good, marketing, regardless. But you chose not to do it around social, but instead to do it for email specifically. And so just walk through the maybe moment. I think the setting was a case conference. There was wine and cheese and an aha lightning strike, if I recall, where you decided not to write it about content in general, not to write it, posted it about social, but to do it specifically around email.
I think there's probably two reasons in here. The more romantic reason is that email kind of is the ugly duckling of the marketing mix. People love to hate it. And so Day, my co-author, Danica Boltz, and I felt like it needed some love. But the real reason is that social is rented space. And I've seen so many amazing campaigns and practitioners in that space just have to change strategy on a dime, or lose followers, lose this traction based on what the platform is doing, where email, like, this is a e our email lists are incredibly important and should be prioritized. Social media does a lot to support the marketing mix, and especially in terms of raising awareness and getting people back off the grid and onto our email lists. But the conversion is where, like, email's where the conversion's happening. It's 3x what we're seeing in social media advertising. So we wanted to make sure, also what we were hearing was, like, email doesn't work anymore, and it's, we're not getting the results. And I was just like, oh no, because you're doing it wrong. So there's this real sense of urgency all of a sudden that we had information that other people didn't have. And we wanted to make sure that they we're using all of the tactics that we had in hand, again, like reflecting a lot on user experience research and this other side of behavioral science and what is applied to the web for marketing that we really didn't see in any other literature. A lot of the other email books were very gimmicky and trying to trick people into doing things and trying to be persuasive. And that's not really what people need. So yeah, so we were excited when it all clicked to give the email channel some love.
So when you say we're doing it wrong, or you're doing it wrong, or they're doing it wrong, like define that. What are just the because we'll start to talk about what good looks like, but it helps us know what bad looks like even as we all live it every day.
Right now, 2024 going into 25, I believe there are a lot of people out there that don't actually know how bad of a reputational spot that they're in with their email, and that are probably seeing very low open rates because all of their email is just going to junk or spam. This is my big fear for our industry, that there are many schools that are seeing open rates in the, if you're seeing open rates that are around 20%, nobody's getting reaching your you're not reaching your audience. And I had a client this past spring that we had that realization on their giving day. An incredible campaign was put together and we weren't reaching anybody. And so we had to take 3 months to fix that reputation. So that's kind of like the scary end. Like I'm hearing, we don't reach people, they don't open our emails, it's not working. There might be actually something technically wrong with the way that you're sending and the reputation that's tied to your domain. So that can be solved. That is kind of the one scary end. I think what I hear most from marketers, though, is they are trying to increase people clicking on things. So the opens are actually, they are delivering, but we're not getting a ton of engagement. I also hear from gift officers, I'm not getting a lot of responses when I'm sending invitations out to people. Is there something I could be doing differently? And then I see, people that are trying to put together stewardship or these like impact messages, newsletters, just crafting them in a way that is completely overwhelming for people. And like, I feel the same way about the K-12 emails that I'm now getting from my child's school. There's so much information in them, and it takes a lot out of you. So it's addressing a lot of these kinds of things. So reputation side, just some like really tactical kinds of things. And then the content too, that's for the audience, not necessarily just what the institution is pushing
Yeah.
out.
Look, those K-12 emails, they have a real unfair advantage, which is we have to read them. Like we're
I
forced
know.
to read everything. They expect we read everything every time.
Yes.
School age, I'm with you on that one. It is, but
Totally.
open rates are high. My click-through rates are high,
Right.
matter how challenging, the content may be. It's
Yeah. But your alma mater can't get away with
your alma mater can't, but let's talk about that for a
that.
second, because I would think on the spectrum of marketing, okay. Especially if you're talking about on the advancement side of the organization, you are starting from a real position of strength, which is we're already customers, right? We've got the institution at the top of our LinkedIn profile. It's on our resume. It's what we talk about when we meet new people. It's, ways that we made friends. And so it's not like on the spectrum of like cold to warm. It's about as warm as any brand relationship
Absolutely.
can get. And so you should have a huge advantage. I think the
Yes.
flip side is that advantage, and we see this in many different ways, it is such an advantage that it has sometimes meant that we can do less well and get away with it because there is that affinity. Whereas when you look at the best marketers in the world who started with no brand awareness, no existing right lead pool, if you will, they had to get there through excellence. And I think when you can marry, right, excellence with the pre-existing relationship and affinity, in the alumni community, like that's where magic can really happen.
Yeah, I think what we all have to grapple with is, we have data in the book that suggests every person on the planet gets 70 emails a day. And that study was done before generative AI was in all of our hands. So I think that's just exacerbated now. And if you feel like you've been getting more emails than ever you have, and that is going to continue to grow at the same time that we have not gotten more hours in the day. So there is data from Litmus that tells us that only a third of your audience reads, and that is for 8 seconds or more. 40% of your audience is spending 2 to 8 seconds on they're skimming. And then a whole nother third only glances at the email for 2 seconds. And the best relationship that you have in the world, this is still going to be the behavior in the inbox, because we don't have that much time to dedicate to reading an email that takes 16 minutes to read all the way through, right? Like, it doesn't matter how warm that relationship is, you just can't get through it. So, I still see a lot, a lot of the email communication has to change to the way that our behavior is changing, just like we would think it would be wild to post a 16-minute long, manifesto on Facebook or Twitter, right? Like, we would never do that. That's not the right thing for the channel. This channel has evolved, and I can remember going to work at RIT and sitting down at my desktop and reading all 12 emails and then doing my job, right? And then, like, meeting with people and picking up the landline and doing, but that is not where we are. So there are some just really tactical things that if everybody knew, how do I get my message across in that 2 second glance, you're going to immediately be more effective. And that's
Well,
the, like, hack. It doesn't work if you don't have the trust in the relationship building part of it too.
so why don't we help everybody get better right now?
Okay.
What I would recommend, but you do this for a living, so you tell me, is what if we spend a couple of minutes walking through the trust triangle, which I think is fundamental, and spend a couple of minutes walking through how to write emails people will read. You have a five-step process that you've shared previously through some of your workshops that I think can maybe make everybody who sticks with us for the next 10 minutes just a little bit better.
Cool. Yes, let's do it. The trust triangle is my favorite model of trust building because it's so simple. It is a triangle, and it's also not new. Like, the core drivers of trust are not new news. This is what Aristotle would have said: ethos, pathos, logos. Now we're talking about logic and authenticity and empathy. And what the authors of the article where the trust triangle was published, Ann Morris and Francis Fry, published in 2020 in the Harvard Business Review, they would say that you need all three to have a trusting relationship. You need to be authentic, but you also need to be empathetic, and you have to have logic that, people can follow what you're doing and what you're saying. It needs to be logical. And if you don't have one, then you will have a wobbly triangle. And I think that's very cute. So that's another reason I love this model. You don't want to have anything that has a wobble because you can lose trust so quickly. And so the way that manifests itself in email or in any kind of marketing message is that the authenticity piece means we got to be real honest, right? Like, we can't say, we got to stop saying, give now, give now, give. Why? Why do I have to give right now? If you have to be so critical about the words that we're using, students need you. Do they need me? Do they need, students are counting on my $50 gift, are they really? Right? Like, we have to be so critical about the language that we're using, about having a voice, about sounding like a human beings in a more robotic world. So that is really the authenticity piece. The empathy piece, like I mentioned before, I think is where we miss more often, is what are we doing to make sure that this relationship feels like we're in it for their success and not just ours. Are we delivering a really great experience? Are we actually adding value? And it, sometimes I think the way I like to think about it in email, because we can make it really simple. Email, usually when you're in your inbox, you're like not in your favorite space, right? Nobody's like, yes, go check email. So if we're the ones in the inbox that are putting a smile on your face, now I've made your day better. And that is a value exchange. So sometimes it's just simply like, can we make people happy today? And then that logic piece, I think, in marketing is really the consistency. Does this, if you're asking me for this now, does that make logical sense based on what else you told me? Are the steps that you're asking me to take really easy to follow?
And so, what's the wobbliest leg of the triangle in advancement in general?
I think we got work to do everywhere. I think we've gotten a little bit better on the authenticity piece over the last decade. Some people are kind of understanding the value exchange, I think, a little bit more. I think we get hit on the logic side is on our technology, and there's still like a lot of frustration in the flow. And so I would stick that on the logic end of this. But yeah, I think, like you said, when you're looking at the social media content, that it was really skewed to all of these asks, and there's no awareness raising, there's very little nurturing, there's very little stewardship. And so we've got to rebalance. That's probably on the empathy end.
Yeah. Look, I feel like there is such an opportunity, given the lifelong nature of the relationship, to sort of always be stewarding so much potential in that regard, where whether it's good experiences through event, digital experiences. I even think about like some of the improvements that I've experienced, like. We used to do these Brown Football Association board meetings before football games in Providence. Well, guess what? It was never really that practical, but like at this juncture in my life, that's really not practical. And there's a lot of people like me. And that's one of the things that once the pandemic hit, all of a sudden those things shifted to Zoom. And it's like record attendance, amazing engagement. Way less logistically complicated for everybody and
More sustainable,
more
more aligned with
sustainable.
mission.
And they never, like almost never are we talking within that attendee base, give now, give now, give now. But then when it's time to give, it is so much easier because you can see who's
Absolutely.
right engaged and who's part of it. And that's where it's not just
You
about
have to do less of it,
yeah,
right? Like
but my
you
point is
actually
like
have to do less of that. You're like less on that hamster wheel of, oh no, we're,
I think some of it is like, how does email as a channel intersect with the other, right? The holistic experience that we're having. For example, my email engagement isn't just going to be about the tactical things that we'll talk about shortly. It's also like, what is my overall experience? How has that
Absolutely.
improved? And the better that that can get, like the more inclined I'm going to be to spend my 8 seconds
Absolutely.
on the Brown football solicitation, for example.
Yeah, in our email workshops, we start with the trust triangle and then we talk about how to make content for people, right? Because yes, you can use email to drive people to take an action, but you can also use it to build a relationship, and you can be entertaining, and you can be, you can provide value, you can provide information, you can be helpful. And so I think one of the challenges, it's almost like standing up a new program, is, well, how do we start doing that? And I do this exercise with my team every quarter where we time travel to the next quarter of the year. We put ourselves in, in the audience shoes in springtime or winter, whatever is coming up. And we think about what do I need during that time of year? And that's how on election day we send a de-stressor and, mindfulness exercises and all of these very timely, helpful things. And why on Thursday, the next call to action email was about getting your alumni wine. We were thinking about the holidays are coming up, and do you want to have your Cornell wine on the table, right? Like, we've already thought through this, and we've done it 3 months in advance. We're able to get the collaborators together that we need in that time. We're able to be really thoughtful ahead of time, and it's not a scramble to write the perfect thing for the moment, because we've taken the time to think about what they need, and we've freed ourselves from, well, what were the last three news articles that the university published? That's what's going to go in the newsletter. Like, that's not going to be relevant. We probably have something that is relevant that was published years ago because we were ahead of ourselves, right? So freeing ourselves from this, like, what's the university news, to know what would be helpful in the inbox, because we're trying to create this habit that when you see an email from Cornell, it immediately that's when I'm going to open. Like, I know there's going to be something in there for me, and that's what I want to be happening subconsciously when they're making these 2 second decisions.
So how do we write emails people will read?
Okay. You need five things. You
First.
need the right sender name. That's the first one. So the from address, or who the sender is. I think marketers spend so much time talking about the subject line. We have like years and years of writing subject lines, but we forget how important the sender is, or that from name, because it's actually bigger. And when you think about your own email behavior, what you probably do is you immediately skim, who did I get email from? That's the first thing you do, and it's bigger, and it's more important, and it stands out. And so there's this debate: is it a person? Should it come from a person, or should it come from an organization? And somebody had a study probably that said if it's a person, then people are going to trust it more, and so it should be a person. But it's whoever the audience member knows and has a relationship with, and that is probably not the current dean of students, right? They probably don't know who even the president is, the majority of your people, right? And so when an email comes from the Cornell University president, the sender name is Cornell president, because that is what everybody knows. So that's the first one. It's got to be the entity, whether that's an organization, or if they do know the person's name, great. That's the from name. And then the subject line. This is also a change. So I have been breaking the hearts of marketing copywriters everywhere. We can't do cute subject lines anymore. The subject line needs to be what is in the email. You have to tell people what's in the email in 6 words or less. It's important because it saves people time. If they only have 2 seconds, we're saving them time, and we're getting our message across in even just in the inbox. But also, email filters are now checking this. Is your subject line matching the content of your email? And if there's a discrepancy there, you're going to end up in junk. So we have to keep our subject line super clear. If there's an action in the email, that's what your subject line should be. If there's a deadline, great. If you can use personalization, if you can use real urgency, not fake urgency. Like, there's actually, your giving streak is actually going to expire, and then you do need to give now, right? But otherwise, just be really clear about what's in the email, in the subject line. And then you've passed the first hurdle. Now you can, now somebody opened.
And
And in, yeah.
so like most of what you're advising on would be in the context of one-to-many marketing content, but you also have said that gift officers and others have reached out more in the one-to-one. I mean, nothing that you've described so far, trust triangle, how to write emails people read, seem like they're unique to the the one-to-many game.
This
Like,
is going to work for anybody who is looking at an email in their inbox. This is really based on their behavior. But if you're that gift officer and you're saying, like, oh, well, they don't know me, what do I do if they don't know my name? Then I would say you need to have your institution in your subject line, so that there is a reference right there in the inbox to your name and the institution.
so let's apply that to like a classic, I'm trying to get a discovery visit with someone. I'm a fundraiser. I don't have, Ashley has been a donor to the institution. Ashley is maybe, let's say that she hasn't been a managed prospect before. She's gone to reunions. I'm Brent, the new fundraiser. I want to secure a visit with Ashley. So what's an example of a clear subject line versus a less clear subject line?
Yeah, I think you want to be careful to not sound like the emails that you read in your inbox that you are going to disregard, right? Like things that aren't clear are, do you have 5 minutes? 5 minutes for what? Or do you have time for lunch? Who are you, right? Like if you haven't already answered those questions, the immediate brain response is like, I don't know. Like, this is confusing. I don't know you. Why you're asking me for lunch? So it might be that you have to do an introduction if this is your first communication. If you haven't had that, if you already had an introduction and now you're telling somebody that you're going to be there in their area, you know, I would say rely more on natural spoken language and less on what happens when you sit down to write an email. You go into this kind of like twilight zone and your English teacher is behind you and they're telling you to use certain words. And so the advice is usually just to write like you would speak if you saw this person at a coffee shop or, you know, you're walking across the campus with them and you want to have lunch. How would you say that? That is going to sound like a human. It's going to come off more authentic. And you will get to the point quicker than if you kind of get yourself into this writing mode. So that's one of the recommendations when you get in the inbox to use really simple language, write like you speak. Don't, you know, if you can say it in less words, say it in less words.
Maybe do less is,
yeah,
is do less. Okay. So simple language is step number three. So a trusted from, a clear subject line, simple language, which you just were hitting on, write like you speak. And then
So then we need to talk about the action-driven links or buttons. If you're using an email client where you're designing an email, what I think the biggest takeaway here is that that's probably the only thing people are going to see in 2 seconds. A button or a link that's highlighted because it looks different. And so we want people to be able to understand exactly what you want them to do just by looking at the link. So is it, do you have time for, you know, do you have time for lunch with me is the question. Can we get lunch is the question. That's what you should have, that entirely bolded or hyperlinked and standing out in the email. If you are writing a solicitation, a mass solicitation, make a gift. Doesn't make a gift to what, right? Like I haven't read your whole appeal. All I read was make a gift. So make a gift to the student fund is so much more descriptive and so much more helpful for me to understand when I first open that email. Oh, they want me to make a gift to the student fund. If I'm interested, I'm going to read more. But what I see a lot of is the give now, learn more about what, what am I learning more about? What am I clicking here for? So that those will help change if you're struggling with click-through rates and you're using links that are described this way, be more descriptive and you're going to see those results.
And then finally, format for scannability. Maybe that's a little bit more one-to-many specific, but you tell
me. No, this works for everybody. There is a reading pattern that we all follow when we open up an email. Our eyes follow an F pattern. We were going to read the first line. We're going to read the next kind of paragraph break, that first line. And then we're going to skim down the left-hand side of the email. And so if you are starting your emails with, it was so nice to see you yesterday, or I hope this email finds you well, or thank you so much for blah, blah, blah. But that's not the point of your email. You have just wasted the best real estate that you have. So use that. We recommend putting that in your signature instead. It was so nice to see you yesterday. It's a great signature. Don't waste your first line, you know, be very specific in your first line, put the button right there in that second line or the, whatever the call to action is. There's nothing special about buttons. Buttons just have more white space around them. So if you're writing an email to somebody and you want them to pay attention to something, put it on its own line by itself. And that's the kind of formatting that really matters for somebody who we know is just going to take that 2 second glance.
Yeah. And then I guess, when success is achieved, you talk about in the book as well the importance of stewardship, which is something we feel strongly about. And I think, frankly, the intersection of stewardship and some of what we've been just talking about is one of the biggest opportunities in the entire industry. For example, after a successful giving day, when a bunch of people convert and make the donation, how long is it until they have like an authentic, personalized follow-up that by the gift officer, for example, where you can have the relationship between the one-to-many marketing, right? That marketing air cover, then teeing up such natural opportunities for that one-to-one follow-up. Hey, Ashley, it's Brent here. Saw that you donated at Giving Day last week. I'm going to be in Saratoga next week. Would you be available for lunch on Tuesday or Wednesday at one of these times? I'd like to personally thank you. Like that, it's like when
Yeah,
that
and I think if
happens.
you plan for that, it might seem overwhelming, like you're going to add all of this stuff, but if you plan for it, you can do a lot of this work kind of in batches and you can be really thoughtful and then you're just personalizing to the person. But if you make it part of your workflow, if you understand that this is a channel that people want to be communicated on, it's the number one channel you're going to hear your alumni and donors want to be communicated on if you survey them. But we got to do it right. Like, we got to be respectful of the time that they have in the inbox now because it's a lot less than we're serving up.
I think in summary, you're doing it wrong. Do it better. Do
Do it
less.
better. Yes.
Right. Yeah.
Make the inbox less of the mess that it is right now.
Well, I hope that many people listening will follow you and follow your work and check out the book. But maybe as we conclude here, I am a perpetual future author. And so, what are the lessons learned? If you could go back in time to that, wine and cheese moment, what advice would you give yourself on writing this book?
Just write the draft, just write it all. Use your, GPT research assistance if you feel like you need to flesh something out more. But write that draft. Don't worry about publishing at all. Because if you have a manuscript in hand, the rest goes a lot. Even if you know an editor needs to really beat it up. That was the best advice that we got. Just write the thing. And it
Love
went
it.
fast. We wrote it in 4 months. Can
4
do it.
months. Well, you should probably give a shout out to
Shout out to my
your
co-author who wrote half of it. Day and I met at Cornell, and spent one glorious year working together. Then stayed in contact, speaking at conferences, and she's now my book wife. We got book married in August, had a big party.
Love it. Love it. Well, if people want to stay in touch, Ashley, what's the best way to connect?
I have a website, ashleybud.com. I write my own newsletter, so if you want to get more email, you can get email from me there. And you can find out everything about the book, mailed it at emailbook.co.
There you go.
Awesome.
Ashley, thank you for joining us. Congratulations on this milestone.
Thank you.
Best wishes for continued success. Love learning from you and with you. And look forward to good things to come here.
Thanks so much. So good to see you, Brent.
All right. With that, we're going to wrap today's episode featuring Ashley Budd, author of Mailed It, nonprofit consultant, keynote speaker, and senior advancement marketing director at Cornell University. Thank you, Ashley, and take care, everybody.